We are so glad that those of you who are here for the first time are here with us. You may really be here for the first time, and the size of this building may put you off a bit. And if you're way up somewhere in the corner of one of the balconies or way in the back, and it seems so far away, you may wonder, what in the world am I doing here in all of this? I have some similar feelings when I stand here and look at all of you, and I wonder sometimes if I ought not to be somewhere else too. And yet something good happens here every year. And if you can manage to be a part of it, then I believe you'll be blessed. Much of it is due to your being here that it happens. Perhaps a small part of it is my being here. The largest reason for it happening is that the elders and the leadership of this church make a conscious effort to lift up Jesus Christ at every opportunity. And wherever the Lord is, there's going to be a blessing. And I hope you'll pray for me this year as we make our journey together. I really don't have any desire to entertain you. I want to keep your attention because of the urgency of the message. I certainly have no desire to call any attention to myself. I have one burning compulsion and passion. I want to lift up Christ. And other than that, I have no reason for standing here before you, none whatsoever. Well, there are going to be a lot of good things happen. Today, it's just packed. We're beginning a meeting tonight at 4 o'clock and at 6 o'clock with Neil Pryor. If you've never heard him preach, you've got a treat in store. He's a man, I've said often, indeed, in whom there's no guile. He's a little boy, Neil is, and if you've not met him, then you're going to be surprised at the little boyishness that comes out of him. And he's so simple and he's so genuine. You're going to love him and you're going to love the Lord that he preaches. That's tonight at 6 o'clock and at 4 o'clock. But then at lunchtime today, we've got something else happening. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I need to explain a little bit about it. We've always wanted an all-church picnic at the beginning of school to pick up on a lot of you who would like to be a part of this congregation. But every time we seem to feed it through, as Terry says, feed it through the fellowship committee, it always blows the computer and just goes bananas, because how in the world do you get the logistics of such an effort as that worked out? So Terry and the fellowship committee worked out a simpler plan. We'll all who want to will go out to the old Camp Wildwood today, right after this hour. But we're going to just simply go out in family units, and as many family units as possible go. Take your sandwiches, your drink, take a quilt, give your own thanks, eat your dinner there. We're going to congregate around the open-air basketball court. It'll be just all out in that area, wherever you want to be. But there are a lot of you students. We're hoping that some, 500 or 1,000 of you will go. Now, you may or may not have anything to eat. We're just going to trust that there'll be enough there. Terry said that he and I are not bashful. If you don't have anything to eat and you haven't eaten over here at the cafeteria before you go, and that's a possibility, you can eat there and then come out there. But if you just want to go and take your chances on eating with us, come on. You can eat out of my basket, and if it runs out, I'll go over and get something out of somebody else's. I'm not bashful. Terry said he's not bashful. But what we're going to have to do, we're going to have to extend ourselves a bit now in order to make it work today. You can go on home and shut your door and not have any part of reaching out into this that we read about at the supper today. They ate together. That was one of the parts of the fellowship and the reality of the early church. Today, we've already eaten the supper together. Now, we're going to go out and enjoy eating together and having that experience together out there at the camp today. Would you go home and make your sandwiches? If you've already prepared dinner, put it in the oven, make you some peanut butter and jelly and bring you some Kool-Aid and come on out. And those of you who are students, the bus is going to leave over here. One bus will leave about 12:15 or 12:30. If you want to ride and don't have a ride, come over there to the Gaines parking lot and let's go. Those of you who are preparing lunches, who are resident members, drive by over there and pick up two or three students. And I don't know what's going to happen, but let's just make sure that we're a part of it, okay? All right. Then tonight, after the second hour of worship, there's going to be a fellowship out on the skating rink. We'll tell you more details about that later on tonight. But that's a good time. You get to meet a lot of people. I'm going to host that, and I'm going to see to it that you meet each other. And it's just a fun time, and we're just hoping that you'll be a part of that too. If you like to skate, and all of those who've been a part of it in years past, be the hosts and hostesses. And those of you who are brand new and don't know where to turn, come on. We'll turn you around and up and down, and it's just good. So we'll look for you at that time. May God bless us now as we study together. I'm convinced that the church today is in one of its critical periods. I think we're at a crossroad. We have dropped in the last 15 years from number one in growth to number 12, or perhaps number 13. That cannot happen without something wrong being there. We just can't drop that far down without there being some fault. Reactions abound in the church today. Visible and invisible ones. Pat Boone is a visible reaction. He's a dear friend of mine, has been for 25 years or more, 27 or 8 years. He's one of the visible responses, reactions to the church, to its problems. There are 1,000 for every one Pat Boone. There are 1,000 other reactions, many of which are invisible, that are seething within and hurting without being solved. Other are visible reactions that you know that are not as public as Pat's. But there are actions and reactions and visible ones and invisible ones. Others are building their religion around powerful, polished, pious pulpit personalities. Men who stand up with such a glibness and I'm not sure, and I don't want to condemn them, but I'm sick to my core over the calling of attention to men. And I'm going through a struggle right now, if you'll allow me just to bare my heart just for a moment. I'm going through a struggle as to just exactly what is my contribution and what is any gospel preacher's contribution to the church in the assembly. Where does it end, and what's the genuine thing? What would Christ do? And there are some facets and some particular pockets in the church that about all they have going for them, it seems, is some professional promoter standing in the pulpit with ultimate polish and all the rest, or some kind of program being palmed off on people. That may be what they have going for them, and it just doesn't set right. And then there are others who are retreating into various types of sectarianism in the church, some knowingly, some unknowingly. Those who are doing it knowingly are usually on the left-hand side. They're out in left field. They have resigned themselves to the fact that they're a sect, and they don't find any reason to fight against it. The ones who are doing it unknowingly are usually in right field and in the very far right, who, because of their seclusiveness and their restrictiveness and their exclusiveness, are narrowing themselves down farther and farther into a reactionary group that cannot be identified but by any other term but just simply pure sectarianism, but without intent. There's so many things happening in the church. I believe the times are demanding a fresh look at the faith that's the motivator of the kingdom. But not only on a broad scale, such as church-wide, individually, we're at a time when I believe that we're at a crossroads in our lives. Many of you who have come to this particular location here are at a crossroad because of the nature of where you are. You've come in, as we noticed last Sunday, to a new situation. It's going to bring a crossroad to you in your faith. You're going to have to make some decisions that you would perhaps prefer not to make. There are going to be some struggles that you would prefer perhaps not to go through. As you are being called and I'm being called daily to a deeper and deeper commitment to Christ, it provides and presents us with a crossroad in our life. As we are being pushed to greater obedience and growth, and yet as we find ourselves many times not being able to respond with the depth of faith that we need to in order to capitalize on and to cope with the problems and the decisions that are made and that are being called upon to be made. And we find ourselves under times of stress, not really possessing always the degree of faith that we need to settle those needs and to fill those needs and to settle the demands that are being made of us and fill those demands. These stresses and all come whenever we are unexpectedly presented with something that we're not prepared for. And let me just mention a very simple one. It's so simple I almost hesitate to mention it. But on campus, you may have come here thinking that you were going to have a roommate. And you get here and lo and behold, you've got roommates. How do you respond to that? And some of you little darlings who've been always pampered and your mamas and daddies have always provided you a room by yourself with no other body infringing on your space, you come here prepared for one other stranger and you find out there's a third one, there's another one, that there are three of you in the room instead of two. And you may then, because of that all of a sudden stress that you're not prepared for, in just that very simple way, you find yourself reacting in a very selfish way, in a self-centered way, and one that simply says, but I want that bed, and that's the one I'm going to have. Or I don't want to share a desk with you. I want my own desk. And you know what? There are going to be some things that you see about yourself and that others see in you that are downright heathen. They aren't Christian at all. And you never realized that it was there. Yeah, there are going to be times of stress. I think the times demand a fresh look at your faith. And I'd be doing you an injustice if I didn't push you to that point where you re-look at your faith. Jesus found himself pushing his disciples to those points the very last night of his life. He was there with his disciples and he pushed them to a point that made them look at some things that they weren't aware of. In the 16th chapter of John, he says to them, I know you believe that I came from God. He said, my Father loves you because you have loved me and have believed that I came forth from him. And then on down a ways toward the latter part of the chapter, they also pick up on that and they pick up on the fact that he was talking plain to them. And he says, I'm going away. You can't go where I'm going right now, but I'm going to the Father. And for some reason or other, it turned on a light in their minds and they said, oh, we understand what you're saying now. And we know now that you're come from God. And Jesus looked at them wistfully and said, do you really now believe? You see, he knew something that they didn't know. He knew they were going to be undergoing times of stress that they were not aware of. He'd already warned Peter of it in chapter 13 of John and said, Peter said, look, I'll go with you to death. Jesus had said, Peter, you can't follow me right now. He said, why not? He said, I'm ready to follow you to death. Jesus said, Peter, are you really ready to do that? He said, you're going to deny me three times that you even know me. And here he says, when they said, we now believe, he said, do you really believe? You see, he was showing that there was an inconsistency between their faith and their profession, their faith and their actions. Their faith was at this certain level here, but it was required to be way down here if they were going to cope with what was ahead of them. And today we say, oh, I now believe. Jesus looks at us wistfully and almost pensively and said, do you really? You're going to deny me this very week before you get through it. You're going to act in a way that, you know, people will say, well, he doesn't even know Christ. And yet here we sit as believers. Jesus always points to the shallowness of their faith in time of stress and says, it's because of your lack of faith that you have problems, or it's because of your presence of faith that you have power. But it was either the presence or the absence of faith that produced their problems or their power. And Jesus always pointed them right back to this central focal point of faith. And that's what I must do for you. That's what I must do for myself. As we begin our journey together through this year, we are going to be making some progress together, but I must start us off back where it really begins, back at the point of faith. That's what Jesus did. As upsetting as it was, as traumatic as it was at times, Jesus still had those men to go back and look at this place of faith, the pivot point of faith. And it doesn't do us any good to talk about a lot of other things until we first of all settle this issue. Do you now believe? Do you really believe? And today I don't have many answers, but I want to ask you some questions. Last Sunday I tried to touch base with you where you were. Last Wednesday night on campus, I tried to touch base with you where I believe you really are. Today, I want to touch base with you where I really believe you are. I believe there are many of us here who need to resolve in our own hearts where we are regarding our faith. And in terms of Neil Pryor's meeting, I couldn't let Neil begin the meeting tonight with my preaching on subjects that would gloss over and that would fill up things that really had not been drilled out first. I couldn't start on things that would load you with guilt and load you with obligations and things without getting back down to the real foundation. Where are you in your faith? Yes, I believe that we need to look seriously and consider where we are in our faith. Each of us here today, in terms of our faith, as well as just people in general, are standing in one of several positions. And you're not probably static in that. You probably fluctuate between this position and this position. Because faith isn't static. If you want to get an idea of the fluctuation of faith, read the Gospel of John and see how the disciples of the Lord are first in this position, then they're over here. And then they flip back over here in a position of unbelief, and then back over here into a position of belief. And then they confess their faith, and he confesses their faith, and then he asks them, "Do you really believe? Do you now believe?" And so there's this ebbing and flowing of faith that never lets it be simply finally pigeonholed to where you know for sure you're always in a state of flux and you're always in a state of growth and development. And here you go and there you go. Faith is, you know, it's a live thing. Anytime you can get a handle on it, put it in a pigeonhole, shut the door on it, lock it up, throw the key away, you know that you don't really have faith in God. Not a living faith. Where are you? I think we're in two or three places. I don't know where you are. See if you can identify yourself. Last year, we did this for those who were new. We're doing it again for those who are new now. Those of you who were here last year, bear with me, but I want you to do something. I want you to reevaluate where you are in terms of where you were last year. You'll probably find yourself in one of these two or three places. Number one, you may be a believer. Who knows he's a believer? And I mean by that you're like Simon Peter said, that though you haven't seen Christ, you love him. And though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with a joy that is exalted and unutterable. You may have that kind of faith. It may be yours. You've fought the battle. You've actually gone through the struggle. You've come through the wrestling with faith, and you've come out with a conclusion. I do believe, small as my faith is, mustard seed-like as it may be, I believe that God is and that Jesus is his Son and that I have committed myself knowingly to him. I want to be his. That doesn't mean that you're perfect. It doesn't mean that you've arrived. But it does mean that there has been something born in you. You have responded in a simple way to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. You say, in effect, "I believe, Lord, help my unbelief, but I do believe." And you've turned your life around. You've made a real concerted effort to put to death that old selfish person in you. You want to give your life to Christ. You're making this a real attempt to get yourself off the throne and get Christ on the throne of your heart. And you've taken yourself and allowed yourself then to be immersed in water. You've done that knowingly. You've done it as being aware of the fact that you're an adult, you're an individual, you have control over your life, and you've given that control over to Christ. Many of you may be in that very condition, and I suspect the majority of you are. In that sense, your life is consistent with your profession. Not perfect, but it's consistent with your profession. And when you do fail and you do sin, you come back with broken heart, mourning, weeping. You come to the cross of Jesus every day, then you lay that burden of guilt at his cross, at his feet, and you say, "Father, forgive me. I'm sorry. I've sinned against you. But I know you're my Father, and I cry out, 'Abba, Father, help me.'" And how many of you find yourselves crying daily for help from God? You're not perfect. You know that. I know that. But you've been born again, and you're experiencing that exhilarating feeling and many times the frustrating feeling of the growth and the development that comes because of your faith that's living. But there's another group of you that you may be in. You may find yourself one of the unbelievers who know that they're unbelievers. You may be here today, though I doubt that you may be, but there are two kinds of people who are unbelievers and they know it. One of them is an unbeliever and he knows it. He doesn't care who else knows it. This kind is usually mean as a snake. They're usually doing everything they can do, doing everybody they can do, doing the school for all it can do, for all you can do it. You're doing everything to get all that you can get and to do just as many people as you can. You're perhaps doing drugs, you're doing sex, you're doing rebellion, you're doing cheating, you're doing everything imaginable. You're an unbeliever, you know it, and you don't give a hang who else knows it. You know people like that, don't you? That may be your condition today. And in a sense, I have to respect you. At least you're not a hypocrite, but be careful. Many times people who are like that use not being a hypocrite as something to hide behind. But remember, hell is full of hypocrites. Just not being a hypocrite doesn't mean that you're going to be able to escape hell. Hell is full of hypocrites, but you've got to be smaller than a hypocrite to hide behind him. You know, you can't hide behind something that's bigger than that, unless it's bigger than you. So that won't do you any good, really. But then you may be an unbeliever, and you know you're an unbeliever, but you don't want anybody else to know it. That's right, there are people like that here. They know all the acceptable language. They know when to turn it off and when to turn it on. This kind usually goes underground. You know all the acceptable terminology. You know when church time is. You know when the vespers are. You know when the devotionals are. You know when all this is. And you just, the social pressure of such a circumstance as this that we find ourselves in is so overwhelming and overpowering, you don't dare buck that. You want to be a part of it because that's the way everybody else is going or seems to be going. And so you just sublimate all of your raunchiness and you put it underneath and you go on with this facade, this veneer. You're an unbeliever. You know it. But you don't want anybody else to know it. Usually this doesn't surface until after you get out of school. This kind of person can go through here undetected for 4 years and not ever anybody know it. But you know when it surfaces? When you get to be about 40, 45, you see your life drifting away, you see your life slipping away, you see your physical power slipping away, you see everything kind of drifting away and life leaving you, not really doing what you wanted to do for 25 years. You've never really done that. As one woman told me down in Hot Springs 2 years ago, my wife and our family were down there in a vacation, and we were on the tennis court, and this woman was there with her children. She came up and introduced herself and said, "You are your brother Woodruff, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "I know you're from the college church." And I, in the conversation, I said, "Where's your husband?" And she said, "He left me. He left me, just walked off after 20 years of marriage. He just walked off. And he told me, he said, I've been doing what everybody else wanted me to do all of my life. Now, he says, I'm going to do what I want to do." It surfaced. Are you doing what you want to do or just doing what everybody else expects you to do? The other real option is doing what the Lord wants you to do. And that never had occurred to that man, evidently. That brings us to the third position you might be in. You might be an unbeliever and not know it. Is it possible that you're an unbeliever and don't even know it? Well, you say, how in the world could that be? Well, one whose life is consistently inconsistent, one who has never known the power of what it means to be a Christian, who's never tasted of the powers of the age to come, one who is busily involved in carrying his religion wherever he goes, but has never found the joy of carrying or finding a position that carries him wherever he goes. It may be that you're an unbeliever and don't even know it. And the only sensation you've felt for years is the frustration and confusion that comes with the conflict that's so deep down inside you that you can't understand what's happening. Why is it that I'm always doing exactly the opposite of what I say I believe? Not just occasionally. We know none of us is perfect. But we find this other person who has finally come to the place that he realizes that there's just nothing going for me. And they come to my office and think perhaps they need actually psychiatric help. And they think that there's a screw loose inside them that they wonder and worry about who they really are. And there have been times when I say, well, it may be that you don't really believe. You may not really believe. It may be that you're in that position. We're not going to have time to go into it in detail, but I just want to draw it down to a conclusion and see if we can't bring it to a real simple common denominator. Listen, there are people who are church people, and there are people who are unchurched people. There are people who are church people that are lost. We're going to leave those who are church people and saved aside, but there are people by the hundreds who are church people and lost, as well as there are people who are unchurched people and lost. Back in the time of the first century, there were these two kinds of people back there. They fell into these two categories, the Jews and the Gentiles. The Jews generally were the church people but were lost. The Gentiles were the unchurched people and lost. That's exactly, and it's just that simple. The Jew, the Gentile, here they were, these two classifications. And out of both Jew and Gentile, Jesus Christ called a people. But I want you to understand that being a Jew was really a disadvantage in those days for this simple reason. The Jew found himself in the precarious position of having been inoculated against religion. That was the difficulty there. Oh, he had the oracles of God, but didn't mean anything to him. He had all the knowledge of what was right and what was wrong, but he couldn't avoid the wrong or do the right. And when he came right down to it, Romans, the 11th chapter, says that the real problem with the Jew was that he had been inoculated with just a small amount of religion to where it almost eliminated him from being a contender. The Gentile was lost and he knew it. The Gentile had had it. He was alienated from Christ. He was separated from the commonwealth of Israel. He had no hope. He was without God. He said, God, help me. I don't know what I need, but I know I'm lost. And his own religions, they had so ripped him off and so left him bleeding on the side of the road that he didn't know where to turn or what to do, but he knew he was hurting. The old Jew said, what do I need a Savior for? I've got the law. And it's such a sad fact that he had just had enough inoculation that it kept him from being really susceptible to a good case of religion. Well, where do we find that sort of a person today? Oh my, where do we ever? Among ourselves? You see, we've taken over the place of the Jewish people. We who? Well, we who were raised in the church. That's right. We who are raised in the church have taken over the position of the Jew. Well, where is the Gentile? He's out there letting it all hang out. That's right. He's over there in the dorm right now sleeping. Sleeping it off, maybe. He may have gone out and gotten drunk last night. He's sleeping it off. Or he's out in the world letting it all hang out. They're the Gentile. We, who are the religious people, have taken over the position of the Jew. That's right. Are you sure that's right? Yes, I'm sure that's right. Raised knowing the difference between right and wrong. That's right. But not having the power to avoid the wrong or do the right. Informed but not transformed sometimes. Oh, I'm not saying this is all the case, but you will know it if you're in that position. If you've grown up having come to be religious and having been taught to be religious but never having been taught to know God, if you've come to know what religion is but not come to know the God of religion, then I suspect that you're one of those powerless ones who has your Boeing 747 loaded down with your do's and don'ts, and also you're loaded down there with a whole surfeit full of guilt, but you don't have any power to do anything about it. Maybe that's the condition that you're in today. Look, I'm not trying to discourage you, but I'm confident of one thing. You'll never come to a saving faith in Jesus Christ without having come to grips with it personally. I don't care how good your mother and father were. I have a mother and father, and I don't believe that there's anybody that's got a better one. My parents were the epitome of Christianity as far as I'm concerned, but I still had to come to personal faith through personal struggle. And you say, well, you're hitting me with something I'm not prepared for. At your age, you better be prepared for it. Now's the time. It's going to come through personal struggle. Don't you wish it didn't have to come that way? I do. But it does. It has to come that way. Second and third generation Christians are prime candidates for being the modern contemporary Jewish religious man, the modern contemporary counterpart of the Jew. Who is that against second and third generation Christians? Raised in a Christian home, perhaps, and we'll put quotation marks around Christian. Raised in the church, knowing what's right, knowing what's wrong, being enlightened, being informed, but holding to a form of religion but denying the power of it, having been denied the power of it, maybe. Where are you? Oh, I'd love to say much more, but I'm going to just draw it to a conclusion. A young girl came to my office long time ago. I don't know when it was. And she was such a fine person, I sensed it immediately. And yet I sensed something that was missing. She was trying her dead level best to do everything in the world that was right. Boy, you couldn't question that. But she said finally in the midst of the conversation, she said, "Brother Woodruff, I'm so loaded down with feelings of guilt and inadequacy." She said, "I can hardly stand it." She said, "I'm just longing to be free. I don't understand. What's the matter?" And I asked her a question. I said, "My dear, have you ever turned your life just totally over to Jesus Christ to do with as he pleases?" She looked a minute and she said, "You know I must do that if I'm going to be saved." I said, "That's not what I ask you." I said, "Have you ever turned your life over totally to Jesus Christ and just totally to God to just say, 'Lord, I don't want me anymore. I'm throwing myself upon your mercy. I'm turning myself over to you.'" She said again, she said, "You know, I must do that. I know I must do that. That's the thing." I said, "But that's not what I'm asking you. Away with this." I said, "I'm not asking you, do you know what you're supposed to do?" Well, I said, "What have you done?" I said, "Have you committed your life to God where you just simply say, 'I'm with you, Lord, from now on, I'm yours'?" She said, "Well, I know I must do that." And for the third time, she sidestepped that confrontation. But she said, "Brother Woodruff," I said, "do you realize what you've done?" I said, "I've asked you three times, have you ever committed your life knowingly, willingly to God?" And I said, "You've sidestepped me every time." She said, "But Brother Woodruff, I'm confused." I said, "How old are you, dear?" She said, "I'm 19. I said, "Oh my, I can understand that." I said, "You've got so much more going for you than I had when I was 19. But I said, "I can understand why you're confused. But," I said, "this is where the issue must be settled. Have you committed yourself to God? It's not how perfect you are. It's not how much you've got on the ball. The kingdom of heaven," Jesus said, "begins like a little tiny mustard seed. And there's not anybody here that can boast of having a great faith. We don't have it. We may be on the way to it, but we don't have it. Maybe some of these great, giant, old people have it. In fact, I'm sure they do. And we can watch them, and we can be careful, and we can follow in their steps. And our elders, you can watch in their... But those of us who are younger, we don't have all that much." But Jesus knew it. And he said, "God's reign in your life starts like a little mustard seed, tiny, tiny, tiny. But then by the time it's over with," he said, "it's like a mustard seed that has grown into this giant tree, and birds come and make their nests in it." The process, the progress, the prospects are tremendous. But where are you in that process? Do you believe? Or are you an unbeliever who knows it and doesn't want anybody else to know it? Or are you an unbeliever who doesn't even know it? Okay, we've got so many good things ahead of us. And I don't want to, God help me, and I pray constantly, don't ever let me say anything that would cause a person to have his faith shaken to where it's irreparable. But I pray also, "Lord, help me to shake folks. Because I know you can't get into the kingdom of heaven without struggle." I know that. Now all this week you're going to be allowed to struggle. And all this year you're going to be allowed to struggle. Thank God for it. Though it's not very pleasant at times, thank him for it. It's essential. And I urge you today, where are you? Have you ever turned your life over to just simply say, "Lord, good or bad, you've got me. You may have made a bad bargain, but you've got me. I'm yours. I accept you. And I want to grow." We hope and pray that that'll be your response. We're really not asking you to respond at this hour. But if you must, and you've got to respond, you've got to get it said, you've got to be baptized, then come on. But what I'm asking you to do is go home today and do some introspection. See where you are in your faith. But if you just must respond, whatever may be your need, you come right now while we stand and sing.